So, yeah.
So what do you want me to do or not?
As an association.
Good afternoon. We're going to open today's subcommittee on public safety. Today is April 4th, 2017. Thank you very much for being here, and thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, for popping in and allowing us to open our committee.
Well, thank you. I notice you probably have seen it's a younger face sitting here than normal, but
usually,
I will go back to
Yes.
What does she say? What does she call it?
Chronologically advantaged.
Advantaged.
I believe our senators will be along shortly. They just had a couple of the things going on. But we will continue our public hearing on House Bill 5015. And you guys know better than we do, regardless of the paper, of what order you would like to come up in. So come on up. Don't forget to introduce yourself, even though we know who you are. And continue, please.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. I'm Ellen Rosenblum, Oregon Attorney General. And this afternoon, we will have the continuation of our presentation from the Department of Justice. We have three presenters this afternoon. The first one will be Kate Cooper Richardson, who is the director of our Division of Child Support and Oregon Child Support Program, followed by Shannon Savell, who is the director of our Crime Victim Services Division. And she will be followed by Mark Williams, who is the director of our Administrative Services Division. So we'll start with Ms. Cooper Richardson.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Kate Cooper Richardson, director of the Oregon Child Support Program and the administrator for the Division of Child Support. So I'm going to be walking you through a little bit about what the Child Support Program is. And in short, we support parents to support children. Every state and territory has a federal Title IV-D program. That's Title IV-D of the Social Security Act. And all the states and territories, so 54, have a child support program. In Oregon, it's codified in Chapter 25. And you'll see that the child support program is the umbrella term that contains both the DOJ Division of Child Support, which is the bulk of the child support program, and then we contract with 25 district attorneys as well. And actually, that will soon be 24. The Josephine County district attorney will be, and the Josephine County itself will be returning the program to state control in the next month. Here's a snapshot of the DOJ Division of Child Support. It's an organizational chart view, as you can see. The 17-19 governor's recommended budget has us at a lower level of FTE. But this organizational chart shows the breakdown of the 570 staff that we have through our field operations, our policy section, and our program services, which are all the centralized services that support this federal child support program. So whom do we serve? We provide services for all families. There are no means tests for services with the child support program, and that's true with all child support programs across the nation. We serve currently or formerly families who were currently or formerly receiving TANF or Medicaid, those who have never received public assistance and just applied directly for our services, and then also when a child's in the care or custody of child welfare, including the Oregon Youth Authority. Just the way that we break down our caseload between the DA's offices and the Division of Child Support. In the Division of Child Support, we have what we shorthand refer to as a public caseload. So these are a child or children who are receiving benefits under TANF or who are in the state welfare system, or when one parent resides in another state and the case may be referred to Oregon from another state. That's a pretty common occurrence. And the DA's shorthand, we refer to it as the private caseload, when parents request the services directly and when no state assistance is involved, or the child or children are no longer receiving benefits and no money is owed to the state. Like I said, there are 25 counties that handle that caseload. In the remaining counties, the Division of Child Support also has that private caseload. So what do we do? We're just much more than just collecting money. This is kind of a breakdown of our core functions, many of which involve a legal process, either judicial or administrative. Locates an important component with a mobile society. Locating parents or assets is becoming more challenging. We use many data sources, DMV, the law enforcement system, the internet, many public sources. We establish paternity or parentage. So a child support order can't be established if paternity isn't established in the first place, and many children don't have a second parent on their birth certificate. In fact, in Oregon, about 35% of children are born outside marriage. That's a lower percentage than nationwide, but it's still significant, and many of those children that are born outside marriage don't have a second parent on their birth certificate. So we use legal processes to establish paternity, which can include genetic testing. No more blood, though. We have the DNA swabs now. Order establishment means actually creating a child support order, a legal obligation for the non-custodial parent to pay. And about 162,000 of our cases have established orders. So, for instance, with the Division of Child Support that is handling the public assistant cases, only a minority of those cases come to us with an order already established, maybe through a divorce decree. Many folks think of child support as you get your divorce, and then you come to the child support program, and the support order is enforced. That's actually a minority of the cases. In the private caseload, more often, it comes in through a divorce, but usually we are establishing that order in the first place. That, again, is a long legal process. The administrative processes that we have diminish the burdens from the state court system and are more accessible to self-represented parties. And so the program is active in both the Office of Administrative Hearings, we're one of its biggest clients, and also the judicial system. The child support guidelines codified in administrative rule are used to establish an obligation that is fair and equitable. It is based on ability to pay. And the courts, anyone establishing a child support order uses the child support guidelines. You can use them even if you aren't part of the child support program. And they are on our website, and there is a very complicated calculator that takes all those policies and places it into a calculator to come up with a fair and equitable support order based on ability to pay and the incomes of both parents. Oregon is what's called an income shares model, and most states do base their guidelines on that income shares. Take the incomes of both parents and put them together. It's essentially looking at the family as a family. They are a family, but they're a non-intact family, and look at the income shares of both parties, and then base the support order, weighing it out against parenting time and other factors, and then coming up with a just and equitable order. Of course, we enforce those orders too, and we use a number of different tools depending on the situation. And income withholding is the most frequent. In fact, it's required unless there is some reason, some exception that applies. Modification is a very important part of child support, and things change for families over the years. And Oregon law requires a mandatory review every 3 years, and the parties can request a change. If they have a change of circumstances, they can request a modification. And a review can lead to an order being increased, decreased, or maybe even stay the same. And we do about 7,000 modifications each year. And then accounting. This is a very big part of our program. We receive, apply, and distribute an average of
$1 million a day. Each workday, it's $1.5 million of cash over the counter, checks, money orders, electronic funds transfer, financial institution transactions, garnishments, trustees, credit and debit, and direct deposits. We're essentially a very large financial institution. We've got to apply those monies directly to each child support account, and many payers have multiple cases, and a single case can have multiple accounts. For each child, there's current and past support for the family and for the assistant agencies. It can be a very complicated accounting. So here's a sort of Harper's Index of the child support program. It gives you a snapshot sense of the scope and scale of the program, some of which might be surprising to you. Our caseload here shows 187,000 child support cases. And as you'll see, the children 21 and younger is 176,000. Our caseload's greater than the number of minor children we serve because our cases have long lives. Some obligated parents fall behind on their monthly court-ordered amount, and we still will pursue child support arrears even after the children have aged out. And as I mentioned, the large financial component with the amount of money we process to. And I think this is a great statistic here. Of the public programs in Oregon with the most child participants, the child support program is number three after public schools, the Oregon Health Plan, and then there is the child support program. Here's those big dollar amounts. We collected $365 million in annual collections last year, so that makes it easy when it's 365 to say it's $1 million in daily collections. Two-thirds of that is collected through income withholding, and 92% of those funds go directly to the family. Only 8% is going to reimburse public assistance. That is a policy shift, national policy shift over the years. The research supports passing through, and Oregon has a pass-through law where we pass through, even if you're on public assistance, we do pass through $50 per child up to $200 per family. And one of the other statistics I like a lot, for every dollar of general fund, we collect $5.01 in child support. So that money is going to the economy, and more important is cost avoidance and keeping those families off, moving them off public assistance and keeping them off public assistance. Here's a breakdown in our program caseload, and this shows the district attorneys are the gray or blue color below, and the Division of Child Support cases are the larger gold bars. This shows over the last few years. So the district attorney offices, the 24 district attorney offices and the Division of Child Support is split between the state 3/4 and 1/4 respectively. I guess actually the reverse. And I will say for the, I think you heard from the district attorneys a couple weeks ago, about the child support work they do as well. Again, they're contracted with the state in those counties, and they are primarily the private caseload, so they're folks not on public assistance. And in the counties where the Division of Child Support is also performing the functions of the DA caseload, the Division of Child Support performs at that same rate. There's a higher rate of paying cases when public assistance isn't involved. So the number here shows you that we're working with some very large numbers, and the case managers in the Division of Child Support handle an exceptionally high caseload, increasing our reliance on centralized services and well-established administrative processes. And it highlights the need also for smart automation and business intelligence, which the new child support system, which we're building right now, can bring to bear so that we can concentrate on the hard-to-collect cases. Just statistic here, and in our Division of Child Support, the average caseload per case manager in our operations branches, 612. In our judgment-only teams, that's a team that has been looking only at cases where The kids have aged out and it's arrears only, no current support, 2,300. And in our financial case managers, which every child support case has a financial case manager, 6,900 cases. This just walks you through the life of a case, and that's just to make sure that you have a clear understanding of what we're doing from beginning of and end. We receive a request for services from either the parent or a partner agency gives us a referral. We move on to locating the parents, because often we get this information, but we only have partial information about the parents. Most often it is the non-custodial parent that we cannot locate, or we need more information. So we use our tools, our state and federal tools that are offered to us to locate, and then we move into establishing the legal paternity or parentage if necessary, and then move into discovery, and that's discovery of all the information we can about that family situation. Essentially, it's financial information about that family, and put that together so that we can come up with the appropriately sized order for that family. And then we establish that order using due process. These are all legal processes, and due process we hold sacrosanct. Of course, we're in the Department of Justice, so we would do that anyway, but everyone is served. There's time periods for appeal, and the order will say the monthly financial support and also health coverage or cash medical obligation. It's not always known that the child support program also is mandated to provide medical support or make sure there's medical support coverage. It's been a bit of a conundrum sometimes lately for the child support programs over the last few years on how to dovetail our obligations with the ACA, but we've been able to muddle through as best we can. The federal laws don't align perfectly, but we are able to make sure there is some sort of medical support in each order. We also enforce the medical support as well. We move into collecting support, and I want to make clear that most parents are trying to do the right thing by far, and they pay their child support, and they do it primarily, as I said, through wage withholding. Some people call that garnishing your wages, but it's actually a wage withholding, so that is a monthly or your pay period actually can be more than monthly withholding that goes directly to our office and then is processed and distributed according to the law and the distribution policies. There's garnishment and offset, and that's tax offset, state and federal tax offset. We are mandated by the federal government to offset from federal returns as well. Then, if we've gotten a payment, then we distribute to the family as appropriate, and if not, then we move on to enforcement actions. So here are our some of our enforcement and collection tools. There's income withholding. Like I said, that's federally mandated, and we work with hundreds and hundreds of employers and payroll offices, both public and private sectors. We have a dedicated employer services unit. Most child support is paid through income withholding. As I said, two-thirds of those collections. Health insurance enrollment or collection of cash medical is also federally mandated. And unemployment and workers' compensation withholding, also federally mandated. So we partner with agencies to receive those funds through electronic funds transfer. Our total unemployment collections for last year, or for federal year 2016, was almost $5 million. State and federal tax refunds, also federally mandated. It's a very important collection tool, although the rise in fraudulent IRS returns has complicated this process, meant that we've had to put, that the federal government sometimes is putting a hold on those while they make sure that there are not fraudulent filings. But our state offset collections for federal fiscal year 2016 was almost $3.5 million, and federal offset collections were $22.6 million. Compliance agreements. This is a very important part of our process to avoid license suspension. We had last year almost 3,400 individual compliance agreements. That is professional, recreational, occupational, and driver's licenses. I will say that the one of the most effective things is for enforcement tools for us is sending out a letter saying if your license may be suspended if you don't contact us for a compliance agreement or to get things moving. Just that letter has spurred a lot of people to call, and it's the hunting and fishing licenses especially affected. It's so true. I mean, it in fact, in Montana, they only just this year passed a law to be able to suspend those licenses. It was fought very hard in the past.
Wow. So what percentage would you say of your hunting and fishing license do you get compliance on?
Let me see here. I don't, actually I do have some. Last year, I'm having to do math in my head here, I think we suspended about 2,000 hunting and fishing licenses, but that's how many we suspended. It's usually about at least double that for folks if you send a letter first. We send a letter, of course, before you suspend any licenses.
Sanchez.
2,000. Yeah, 2,000. Yeah, 2,000 were suspended, which actually, in the suspending, will often lead someone right into compliance. But the letter going out, I don't have that figure for how many letters went out, but it usually works out to be about double.
Okay.
It's a very effective tool.
Sounds like it.
All right.
Go ahead, Rep. Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hi.
Question. Hello. I know this is a very bizarre place for this to sit. 2,000 hunting and fishing licenses. What about actual driver's licenses? And obviously the immediate remedy is pay your child support and we won't take your driver's license away. What does it take to get your driver's license back?
To get it back?
Yeah.
Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chairs.
Representative Sanchez.
I'm going to lean sideways to talk to you.
No.
It's very bizarre.
Here, how about we do this?
There we go. So last year, we suspended 9,388 driver's licenses.
Wow.
However, you can get that back by entering into a compliance agreement, by paying off your arrears. But entering a compliance agreement is very often the very first course, because or sometimes requesting a modification, but they do have to make some payment mm-hmm. in order to get their driver's license reinstated. And we do a lot of reinstatements.
Thank you. So let me just say, I've heard people complain.
Of course.
We're little complainers. How am I supposed to work if I don't have a driver's license? And I would assume that you do essentially the work modification for driver's licenses, that type of thing.
Co-chairs and Representative Sanchez, we don't do work modifications.
Oh, really?
No, we don't.
No.
That's why that letter is very effective. And frankly, we don't want to suspend anyone's license, because we do agree that for very often you need your license to be able to work. What we're looking for is to bring the payer into compliance, the parent paying support into compliance with his or her order. And it might be that order is too high for what they're making, and so we can start the modification process, because it should be based on their ability to pay, but they've been ignoring it for a long time. That's why the due process is so important up front, mm-hmm. is to get the letters out saying, hey, you're to this level now, and you're putting yourself at risk, and potentially your job at risk. Please call us and let's work out something so we don't have to suspend. When we do suspend, it's the same answer. Please call us and let's work out a compliance agreement, or have a way to get this paid off. We'll reinstate. We can do that overnight, reinstate a driver's license overnight.
Really?
We do a match with the Department of of motor vehicles.
I'm looking at your tool list. Is jail time one of the tools in the toolbox?
Why, yes, it is.
I don't see it on there.
No, it is and it isn't, Mr. Co-Chair. I'll run through just a couple more here, and then I was going to actually address that as well.
Thank you.
So passport restriction, I just wanted to make sure that's clear. That's federally mandated, and that's when the total delinquency is in excess of 2,500. It prevents an obligated parent from receiving a new passport or renewing an existing passport. I suspect this will become even more important as passports are required more and more for travel. The for passport denial, it does continue. There is not a compliance agreement with the passport denial. That's happening at the State Department level. And it's continues until the delinquency is paid in full. There are very few exceptions, sometimes for a death in the family or something like that. It is an effective tool. And then we can do liens on property and money awards. We have a title and escrow collections desk. We have do estates and inheritance as well. So one tool not on this list is contempt. And that is commonly understood as a tool that child support programs use frequently. However, it's actually a last resort tool that we use, but it's an important one, a very important one. The Division of Child Support has a contempt program. I know that you heard recently from the Civil Enforcement Division, Lisa Unland, and her wonderful team of attorneys who really aren't represented on my org chart, but we have a team of 10 attorneys that is working with the child support program. So we are not only part of the Department of Justice, we are also a client of the Department of Justice, and we're treated just like a client, and we pay the bills just like a client. Part of what that team does is handle our advice and counsel and our representation in court and sometimes in hearings as well. And we have a contempt program that we work with our AAGs and our offices where we find cases that contempt is going to be the best option for them. We do, there's plenty of research at the federal level that shows that contempt up front is not an effective tool. If you put same reason for not putting someone, taking away the driver's license, putting them in jail doesn't help them earn any money. That said, it can be very persuasive, and there are times that there are those who are able to pay but unwilling to pay. We have many that are unwilling, willing to pay but unable, and we have those that are willing and able. But there are some who are unwilling and able to pay, and contempt can be a very effective tool for them. Last year, our attorneys and the Division of Child Support handled 535 cases that went to contempt in courts across Oregon. Those 535 cases were bringing in about $100,000 before contempt. After contempt, the collections on those cases was up to $1.3 million. So it can be a very effective tool. Sometimes it means entering into a compliance agreement in court. Mm-hmm. In many of our courts across the state, our AAGs have a good relationship with the court. The Department of Justice has an excellent reputation in all our courts across the state, and in some counties, we have a specific docket day just for child support.
Rep. Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in some of my other work, I work with folks coming out of the prison system.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some of them are fortunate enough to learn about the capacity essentially to stop their child support while they're in prison incarcerated, because obviously they're not making much money there anyway. Mm-hmm. And some of them don't. And some of them come out with significant bills to child support, which of course is also compounded by the fact that they often can't get jobs because of the felony background. What happens in those instances? I haven't followed up with too many folks around that, but I do know that some folks who were able to get a job and then, of course, ended up having to pay their child support or go through this process. And so I was just curious about what happens with that and what happens with that arrears that it just sort of sits there, it seems like, for some folks who are just not capable past that, especially with the prison situation.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Sanchez, yes, you're correct that we do have a program. In fact, you'll see a policy bill in this session, too, that is making some adjustments to that program because there was a federal rule that expanded it to all states. Oregon was already kind of ahead of the curve on this, but there are some tweaks we need to align with the new federal rule. It used to be that you had to request a modification, and it was a modification to zero while you were incarcerated. And you're right, some people did not, and their arrears piled up. And there was good data to support that. There's good data to support that the increase in arrears really prevented them from really getting to where we needed them to be on the other side. They have to be successful in their reentry in order to become paying child support in the future. So we do enter into compliance agreements also with them to the extent that there may be some state debt as part of those arrears owed. We can work. That's the last thing that's ever paid. Debt is paid to the family first, but there are ways that we can work with them on state debt. And there are sometimes that the parent receiving support, and we've seen this surprisingly often, will satisfy those arrears. They're owed to that person, but they can satisfy those arrears so that it does come off their books. Mm-hmm. And we do, even in our current program, we do have the parents who are receiving support when they know that the father or the parent who's been paying support has gone to prison, they will initiate a modification because they know they want that person to be successful on the other side as well. We now have there's an administrative rule that allows us on our own initiative as the child support program to start that modification too, because we're interested in getting that person to become compliant in their responsibilities to pay and support their child. And when you come out with great arrears, it drives a wedge in that family.
So on the contempt cases, who foots the bill for that? Is it the county or the local jurisdiction that carries the tab of all the associated expenses? Does the state help offset? Is the individual who, you know, gets put in jail, do they increase their tab? Who pays for that?
Co-Chair Winters and Co-Chair Stark. The state, let me back up a little bit. So they're part of our budget, the child support program budget, so DAs in the DA's office, part of their budget and part of the Department of Justice budget. Those costs, legal costs, come out of our budgets. There is not attorney's fees, if you will, attached to someone who is in contempt. Child support is not seen as a punitive action. That child support is intended to go to the child, not to the state. And so we do not tack on arrears or some other fee to those parents because we want to ensure that they become regular and compliant. And so adding to the debt could be a barrier to that.
Thank you. And real quick, just before you move on, we don't need to discuss it all at this point. Would you send me information? I'm interested in what it means for a county to hand it back over.
Absolutely.
Because you said Josephine is in the next month and 25 counties have. Interested in that whole dynamic, but that can be offline.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, in prison, in the times I've visited, they've talked about people have earnings, they have jobs, and a portion of that goes to child support, they always say. So somebody's waived that for the time being, they still get that little piece of it, or?
Co-chairs and Representative Barker.
there's very little that it doesn't work in the same way anymore. I think it did originally, but there isn't very much to that anymore. I will say the modification to zero, just in case, is only if there's not an ability to pay. There are times where people go to prisons and they do have assets of or income coming from another source. And in that case, if they have the ability to pay, they still pay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you covered this before I came in, just tell me and we can talk offline. When we have a parent that qualifies for social programs, whether it be food stamps or TANF or whatever, and there's an absentee father, for example, what do you do to – is there a program or a method where, let's say, a young mother signs up for TANF or other programs, do they have to report the status of the parent of their children? And if so, what's that process? And what if that parent is out of state? How much do we do to try to find them and help them be responsible?
Co-chairs, Representative Huffman, I sort of hit it, but let me hit it again. The locate function that we have as part of our program, which is locating parents and assets, when someone applies for social service benefits, well, for TANF, let's use that example. Food stamps doesn't apply in this way, but Medicaid or TANF, when they apply, they, one, assign their rights to child support to the state, but also they're obliged and they have to sign saying they will cooperate with the child support and at that time they are naming the, if there's not a parent on, they name the other parent if they know that other parent, or they name an alleged father, and we get, as if it's a father situation, we get as much information as we can through that referral process, and then there is a mandatory referral. We take that information and then we start looking. And we have many different locate tools. And yes, we do cross borders. It's national. We have national search tools. In fact, in our new system, many of those will be automated. Very many of those will be automated. We work with other states. Then if we do locate someone in another state, then there is a whole process of intergovernmental work.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. One comment that I want to get on the record now, because I'm going to shut up. I'm not going to say any more. So I just wanted to thank you along the lines of child support for all of your assistance and loaning Shannon and Aaron and others to the trafficking work group and supporting those efforts. It's really appreciated.
And we're at a point where we have 52 minutes to make it through 42 slides. So we will try to let you go.
Okay. Well, thank you. Then I'll continue, and I can be quick about it. This just shows the total child support collections that are distributed in Oregon. Again, the blue is what's going out to families. The others, the $29.5 million there at 2016, the smaller amount, those are state recoveries that come back to the state. The most important thing on this slide is that every general fund dollar from the state is matched with two federal dollars. That's a very high match, somewhat unique among social service programs. And so that sets our child support program apart. So that means that any dollar provided this program, one, you saw that we collect over $5 that goes right out to families, but then we also are receiving $2 to help us run this federal program. These are our policy packages, and I'll be talking more about those the next time you get to see me here at this table. But one does go to our child support system project, and you'll be hearing a lot more about that. And we just presented to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. And then, of course, we have our continuing request. We're midway through our project right now to have, we have one of the oldest
systems in the nation and are looking forward to having much more accurate and secure data in our new child support system. Every state has to have a federally certified system. And then also we'll be coming back to talk to you about a restoration of our revenue reduction.
Co-chair.
Co-chair Winters.
Just to go back, how much have we invested to date in the information system, the system that you just referred to, the child support systems project?
Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters, to date, somebody running up the mic, to date number? I will tell you that the total projected for the project at this point in time is $129 million. That is total federal funds and state funds. We are in the highest biennium. It's a multi-biennium, and right now in this biennium in 15-17, it's about 48 million. I will bring that number back
Would
to you more
Would you bring it
specific.
Back? And,
absolutely.
And when we started the investment, my brain's not going back that far.
Let me see if I can get here. Like I said, here's a little bit about it right now. Now you're making me wonder how much information I have on the next slide. Nothing. So I will bring that information back to you because we will be coming back in phase two to talk more about that project.
Thank you.
And but as I said, it's one of the oldest systems in the nation, COBOL programming and green screens. And we work, so we've been working with our federal oversight office on a multi-year, and starting back in about 2009 is when we very first started that project. And as far as preparing for it, we went through whole feasibility studies, a lot of federal hoops to jump through that are now aligned pretty close with the stage gate process, and we've entered into the stage gate process as well. So we're in the developmental stage right now, and we are actually writing code right now. And so we'll talk more about policy package 241. But one thing I want to emphasize here that security is paramount to the Department of Justice, and it is especially important for the child support program and all child support programs because we have federal tax information and there are many, many IRS rules. We have a lot of confidential data in our system, and so we see ourselves and our system as a leader in its IT security. Even with the system we have now, it is heavily screened and does meet our requirements, but frankly, we don't have the data reliability that we need to have and go forward. There we are in with our account reductions and our reduction impact. And did I speed this up for you a little bit then?
I actually wasn't trying to speed you up. I was trying to get these guys to stop talking.
Stop talking.
Oh. I knew what he was doing.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, but I've been known to be long-winded as well. So can I have any questions about how our program works or any questions about the slides you've seen? I will follow up on the questions you've asked that we didn't have the immediate answer to.
Mr. Chair, he asked about the 25 and the waiver. I think share them with the entire committee, Mr. Borden.
Absolutely.
And just not a question but a comment. This is probably one of the most well-ran programs that we have. I commend you. I've been around a long time, and I was around when they first started all the conversation about setting up a national collection system for child support. And I've got to tell you, over the years and all the tools that have been added to the toolbox and what have you, and I just want to commend you for the work and the contribution that's been made to families and to the state of Oregon.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you. Oh, wait. I probably wasn't supposed to do that. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
if I might, co-chairs, Winters and Stark, for those of you who are not here when I earlier announced our presenters, we will now hear from Shannon Saval, who is the director of our Crime Victim Services Division. Take it away.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. My name is Shannon Saval. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Services Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. Three things that have an enormous impact on the lives of victims of violent crime are financial assistance, safety, and advocacy. The goal of the Crime Victim Services Division, CVSD, is to provide a safety net for some of the state's most vulnerable people. We have 38 employees and three different sections. And our cornerstone of our victim services programming is the Crime Victims Compensation Program. This program started in 1978. All 50 states and the territories have a compensation program. It's funded through a combination of state and federal funds. And in Oregon, it provides up to $47,000 in financial assistance to victims of violent crime. This covers counseling, funeral expenses, loss of support, and loss of income. It also pays through this program for sexual assault emergency exams and child abuse assessments. The number of applications and claims we've received since 2004 has remained relatively even. You can see last year it was 5,336. However, our total claims that we've paid out has almost halved in the last 2 years. As I've been able to discern through looking at the numbers, I believe this is associated with the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of OHP. So we are watching closely what happens moving forward, because my expectation is if there are significant modifications or any kind of repeal, that we will see our numbers go back. Our compensation funding is, our compensation program is funded through a variety of different avenues, 10% from collections, 47% from punitive damages, and 43% from the criminal fines account. And I'll talk a little bit more about punitive damages later on. I said collections, and so it's important to note that in our division we have two revenue agents who alone collect over $1.2 million each biennium. These are two individuals that collect restitution, court fees, and compensatory fines. So essentially, if we pay out on a compensation claim and the case goes to the criminal justice system, we will seek a restitution order, and then we have two agents in-house who will collect on that order. When they collect the restitution owed to the state, they'll also collect the state fines and fees, and those will be then turned over directly to the general fund.
What percentage of those do you actually bring in? So out of all the judgments and the order that you just referred to, what percentage do you manage to collect?
Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, we bring in a very small collection, a very small portion. The last time I looked into the numbers was about 6 years ago, and the state at the time was owed over $150 million in restitution dating back to the 70s. Typically, restitution is routed through the Oregon Judicial Department. My understanding is they typically keep claims for up to a year, and then they kick them to the Revenue Department. I do not believe that there are any active or aggressive collection actions that are taken. We actually have a fairly good record, considering we have two agents who do this. And you've probably heard from the Department of Corrections that they have a system upgrade that they're looking to implement. And what it would allow them to do, and for us to do, is to provide them with the names of offenders that we have in our program. And then it would allow our system to talk to each other so we could identify offenders who maybe get a large settlement or something of that nature and could pay more restitution. So that's something that is in the works. And if I may, it's also a really nice policy proposal, because it takes into account money that should be set aside for reentry into society, money that should be set aside for savings, child support, and some other things. But yeah, it's a very, very small percentage.
Senator Frederick?
Thank you. And I want to talk with you at some point about what portion of that is the court fees and what those court fees are for.
Co-chairs, Senator Frederick, I don't have numbers in front of me. I can tell you from what I've looked at, there would be a significant portion of that would be from court fees. There are lots and lots of restitution orders outstanding. And there is, tens and tens of millions of dollars to victims of crime, but there's also a significant portion that's court fees and assessments.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Winters.
Talk to me a little about whether or not there is still that the judicial branch is holding these for a year before turning them over to Department of Labor. Is that still a continual practice?
Co-chairs, when I looked into this at length about 4 years ago, because we did a pilot project for restitution collection, and many of you are familiar with that program. At the time, that was the general process, was I believe that they had them, and they actively did seek collections. At this point, I may have spoken out of turn. I'm not sure what they do right now, but that was the practice.
Because we've been prompting all of the agencies to be a little more speedier in turning collections over to Department of Revenue so that they're not so difficult to collect. So we'll follow up with the judicial branch on that particular question.
Thank you. So it goes almost without saying that safety is a huge concern for victims of violent crime. The Address Confidentiality Program in the Department of Justice allows victims of stalking, sexual assault, and domestic violence to use a post office box address for DOJ as their address of record, which means that they are offered a measure of protection from their offender who would, you know, traditionally seek out their location through perhaps voter registration or other things like that. DMV records are also included in this. So we have, as you can see, about 2,200 pieces of mail a month. We have over 1,800 participants at this time. The program has steadily grown over the years.
Representative Parker.
So I had a question came up recently about that. So somebody who has the disguised address and everything, they want to purchase a firearm. They can't fill out the form at the gun dealers, so they're unable to purchase a firearm because they have this missing piece. Where do you live? Well, I can only tell you. Mm-hmm. Post office. And so can you suggest any way around that? I mean, are we going to have to write a different law to accommodate them?
Co-chairs, Representative Barker, I am aware that there was a bill that was proposed this session. I don't have the bill number, that I believe was going to exempt ACP, so address confidentiality, participants from some piece of the background check. Now, I'm not sure if that was simply limited to, if that had to do with perhaps what the relationship was in their transfer. So I don't know the details. I can look into that and send it to you. Otherwise, I think it would have to be a legislative fix. Otherwise, at this point, that individual is probably then saying, okay, I'm going to give you my actual address of record, if that would be something, if they truly want to proceed down that avenue, and that is something that's going to
I'll take another look at those bills and see if I can find that one. Thank you.
Another way that you can provide, or that we can provide, safety to victims of violent crime throughout the state is through training and advocacy. We've been very fortunate, particularly under the leadership of the Attorney General, to be able to further develop and create some new programs in the last few years that are having a really significant impact on training levels, both in law enforcement, prosecution, victim service providers, advocates. And the areas of victims' rights, post-conviction advocacy, domestic violence, and trafficking. I'm just going to highlight a couple of these briefly, but the post-conviction advocacy program is one I am given to understand from working with the National Crime Victims Law Institute that it's one of the kind of premier programs in the nation, that there aren't a lot like it. And we have one advocate who works with survivors and family members as they move through the appeal and post-conviction process. So if you can imagine, these are families typically that have gone through the long process of investigation, court, the initial trial court process, and then, you know, some number of years later, they find out that the case is back up for appeal or post-conviction relief or federal habeas corpus, and suddenly now 10 years later, they're back in it again. The trauma is reactivated, and they're looking for support, and they're looking for guidance. So we have one advocate in the state who works through the Department of Justice with these cases, and most recently, what that advocate did was accompany the Christian Longo, in the Christian Longo case, the family of the wife and children were present for all 8 or so days of the post-conviction trial. The advocate was there to explain the process, what they could expect, help explain and facilitate, you know, a legal analysis when they had questions about what happened, and actually even provide the family, went out and bought cushions because the family is sitting on hard benches for days on end listening to these horrible facts. And that's what they do. And it might sound like a very small thing, but for those folks, typically they've had very limited counseling at the beginning. They have post-traumatic stress. They're traumatized. And then to have one person that can help them figure out how to navigate this abyss is absolutely the pivotal for them and their healing and moving forward. And then I'd like to also note the Human Trafficking Intervention Program. Representative Huffman will be very familiar with this. But with his guidance and with the Attorney General's leadership, we've been able to actually establish the first kind of coordinated response in the state for trafficking. How do you identify human trafficking? What does a community need in order to identify it? How does law enforcement, prosecution, human services work together in a multidisciplinary team to not just identify but to develop services for trafficking? We have a human trafficking intervention coordinator who had a caseload in Portland when they initially started developing a program like this. And she's working with counties throughout the state. She brings law enforcement partners out. They conduct regional trainings. They've been to Ontario, Jackson County, Klamath Falls, Pendleton, Deschutes. They continue to go out. And the goal is ultimately for this to expand to all 36 counties. I feel like this is one of the foremost programs like this in the nation. And it's interesting because not many people know about it. And it was done with some legislators that sat around a table and decided this was an issue, and an attorney general who decided that she was going to make it a priority, and we've done it with very little funding. I then want to move and talk about the grant management section. This is part of our advocacy and the work we do. We have 9 state and federal grants. I'm not going to talk about each and every one of them. We have the federal grants listed above. These are federal grants, and they're a combination, but mostly they are formula grants that we receive on a regular basis. And then we have the discretion to use them for foundational services in the state of Oregon and then also to have competitive grants. VOCA funding, as you can see, the Victim of Crime Act, that quadrupled about 2 years ago. And as a result, we now have 387 grants throughout the state. And the purpose of the increase to VOCA was to build capacity, and we are doing that. So we're seeing a great response around the state and just some really wonderful work. The state grants I would like to talk about a little in depth because this affects everybody here. We have the District Attorney Victim Assistance Program grants. These grants, the $53 million, they fund crisis intervention, notification, actually the advocacy services I just talked about with respect to post-conviction. The District Attorney Victim Assistance Programs provide that in each individual county. I think it's important to note that in half the counties, they don't receive any actual county funding for these positions. So this $5.3 million is the bedrock funding for the constitutional statutory rights that victims are required and should have. And without these advocates, they don't know about them and they're not empowered to actually move forward in the criminal justice system. The Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Grant is a mouthful, so we call it the CAMI grant. It's a two-prong grant. It's about $12 million total, but it essentially funds the multidisciplinary intervention teams in all 36 counties. It funds the child abuse assessment centers where child-centered, trauma-informed interviews are conducted with child victims. It funds the training that goes hand-in-hand with that. I had a couple of statistics. I think that they're a little old, but as of last year, the child abuse assessment centers provided services to over 6,200 children a year. Most who were seen were 6 years old or younger. According to DHS, there were over 10,000 confirmed of child abuse cases, I believe, that year. And though the Child Abuse Assessment Center's budgets were restored in 2009, they were restored 2 years ago to 2009 levels, they still turn children away. We have centers throughout the state, I can think of Hood River for one, that are not open full-time. They have 2 or 3 permanent staff and are constantly seeking additional funding through fundraising, et cetera, to have full-time medical providers and advocates and things of that nature.
Shannon, Mr. Chair, Liberty House I'm going to send everybody an invitation because we're getting ready to announce the opening of the other piece that allows for the expansion of here in Marin County. But most of the CAMIs actually do robust fundraising at their local level. I don't want individuals to think that this is just state dollars. They actually, communities have been across the state extremely involved in this particular issue. But I will be giving all of you, it's while we're still in session, and they will be having a ribbon cutting here in Salem. And I hope you can attend, Shannon, and you too, Madam Attorney General.
Madam Co-Chair, I've already RSVP'd.
Oh, thank you.
April 25th?
Yes.
Good. Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, thank you for pointing that out, because that's a really important point, actually, with all of these state grant funds, that these programs, almost to a program, are funded with their community support. They cannot subsist. They cannot do the level, provide the level of services that they do and that they do extremely well without their community support, because we simply don't fund them to that level, and the feds don't fund them to that level either. So it's truly amazing. Oregon has a really robust response to child abuse intervention and investigation. We still need far more. But the people that work in these, particularly in the child abuse assessment centers, are just remarkable people and always looking for ways to maximize their resources and provide more and more advocacies and services for children. So the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund, we call it ODSVS for short. This was created, I believe, in 2007, and at the time, it was created by the legislature. It's general fund money, and it was, I believe, $1 to $2 million, and really the goal was to try to get an advocate, a person who might be available in each jurisdiction to exist. I mean, there really wasn't anything additional to the funding. Over the years, the legislative body has increased this, and you doubled it 2.5 years ago, I believe. This is foundational, absolutely necessary funding, and the reason why it's so necessary is that of all the other funds that you've seen me go through, many of those are federal, and they come with limitations and certain parameters that have to be observed, reporting requirements that sometimes can be very onerous. This money is the money that these programs can use for their essential services, their essential FTE, to basically keep their doors open. They provide shelter services, safety planning, 24-hour hotlines. Currently, you're funding 77 programs for $8.9 million. And this includes, I believe, 7 of the federally recognized tribes in the state of Oregon, as well as about at least one program in each of the 36 counties. So historically, we're going to move on to state discretionary grants, which is going to tie in with punitive damage dollars. Historically, when there has been money, CVSD through statute has the discretion to make additional grants. It typically comes out of punitive damages. And over the years, we've funded the National Crime Victims Law Institute, the Oregon Crime Victims Law Center, and other organizations that provide really key services all across the state. Currently, we only maintain one grant out of this fund, and that's for the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. I'd like to refer to my notes to this really quickly because the work they do is so important. They are an independent nonprofit. They're the only agency in the state providing consistent trauma-informed, victim-centered training on investigating and prosecuting sexual assaults in the state. Their training is essential to increasing reporting and the quality of case development that we have in the criminal justice system. Some of their critical programs include the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program and Sexual Assault Training Institute. And I know that information, but I wrote it down because I wanted to make sure I said all of those words, because they're all really important. The trauma-informed focus, the focus specifically on sexual assault investigations and trauma-informed interviewing techniques is really essential to, frankly, to increasing the reporting of sexual assaults and also the prosecutions of them across the state. So they're a phenomenal organization that we work very closely with, and they're doing great work. And that brings me to a bit of an in-depth discussion of punitive damages, and then I will wrap this up. This is how we fund the actual staff at CVSD. As you can see, 41% is punitive damages. I'd just like to note that 41% of our staffing is funded through punitive damage dollars, and 47% of our compensation, crime victims compensation program, is funded through punitive damages. So punitive damages have provided the absolute foundation for CVSD since its inception as a section within the criminal justice division of DOJ. This is so critical because we've come to the end of the era where there are an abundance of punitive damage awards available. Most recently, we received a $10 million award, but it was over 9 years in the making as it went through the appeal process, it went to the Supreme Court and was kicked back down. With the advent of tort reform, we are no longer looking towards a future where we will expect every few years to have a large infusion of money through punitive damages. Some of the things that we fund with punitive damages are the post-conviction advocate, the crime victims' rights program, the future of the trafficking intervention program, and the trainings associated. We also fund the trainings associated with the domestic violence resource prosecutor. And that's key because 7 or 8 years ago when that position was created, there was no DV-specific prosecution training in the state. And now prosecutors, when they are hired, they expect to go to the 2 annual trainings that are given specifically by Aaron Greenwald through DOJ on domestic violence prosecution. It's an expectation that every jurisdiction looks to. These programs, these trainings, are funded through punitive damage dollars. The reason I am bringing this up is because we don't see many of them coming down the pipe anymore. And also, the governor's recommended budget does discuss a significant cut to our general fund to be then backfilled with punitive damage dollars. The $10 million punitive damage award that we received this year could fund CVSD through 3 biennia, maintaining what we're doing now, the trainings, the advocacy, those levels. But the minute that money starts getting, whether it's swept or needs to be used to backfill, suddenly that becomes foreclosed to us, and we're starting to look at maintenance efforts. What do we need to cut back? How are we going to be sustainable? And these are programs that the state has always looked to CVSD to provide, and frankly, nationwide, they're looking to us to provide some of this. And I just want to point that out, because as legislators, you've created an environment where CVSD and DOJ has become, and Oregon has become, a leader in victims' rights services, victims' rights legislation. It's really phenomenal to get to travel around the nation and talk about this, and I very much am hoping that we can keep the punitive damages intact so that we can continue that work, because it's groundbreaking in a lot of areas. And for such a small state, it's such a pleasure to be able to say that. So thank you.
Are there any questions? I have one that seems a little off topic from your presentation, but I asked it in judicial, and they said to wait for you.
Okay.
So specific to the crime victims compensation program, and do you guys have a tough time coming up with providers to do the counseling for that? And the reason I ask is, and I'm also curious the second part of the question, because I assume that you do. You maybe not. I hope I'm wrong. The provider rate that you pay for those counseling services for those crime victims is like half of what, you know, most CCOs pay. And so I just have assumed that you would have a tough time finding providers. Do you? How is that rate set?
Co-chair, members of the committee. So it's a bit of a complicated answer, or long, I should say. We have difficulty finding providers in certain parts of the state. What that typically means is we're a payer of last resort. So what actually happens for us is that we'll have a survivor who's a part of the program, and they'll say, I'm trying to find someone that will take OHP in Douglas County, and I can't get in for 6 months, and I need to go. And then they talk to us, and what we will do is we will agree to pay outside. Even though they have insurance, we will pay that as part of the program. That provider is going to then take the reduced rate, because and statutorily, you actually, once you accept that rate, you cannot seek out additional funds.
As an aside, my wife is a professional counselor, and I do all of her billing, and okay. I've had many interactions with you guys.
Okay. We actually don't have problems with that, because the rate we're using is either, there are a couple of things that are tied to other programs, and my mind is blanking a little bit. A couple of things that we pay for are tied to the workers' compensation grid, mm-hmm. I guess it is. And the other ones are tied to contractual agreements, I think, with OHA. And then I think there might be one other way that they're set, and I can get back to you, but we don't do it arbitrarily. So I think it's a range of like $67 to like $148, I want to say, for, say, an average counseling session. And those are tied to very specific things, and I can get you the information in more depth, if that's okay, via email.
Yeah, that works. I'm just curious, and I'm glad to hear that you're not having a tough time finding providers. So,
If I may, I think one of the issues is that when they go through our program, they know they're going to, a provider knows they will be paid, and we're typically paying for 10, 15, 20 sessions, so a significant relationship building, so that may be one of the reasons.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon once again, co-chairs, members of the committee. Our final presentation will be by Mark Williams, who is the director of our Administrative Services Division.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. It's incredibly difficult to follow up that presentation with a spirited presentation about accounting and HR and IT, but I'll do my best. First of all, Admin Services provides the business services.
Please say your name for the record.
My apologies. My name is Mark Williams, and I lead the Administrative Services Division for the Department of Justice.
Thank you.
We provide the business support services for the department and the programs that you've heard about yesterday and earlier today. And no doubt you've heard from several agencies about their administrative services function, so I will spare you going through and talking again about accounting and HR and IT and operations and tell you a little bit about what we've been up to. However, if you do have specific questions about any of those things, I'd be happy to talk about them, so please don't hesitate to ask. Here's what our organization looks like. Again, four different sections. We have HR and financial services and information and operations. On to our sections. In addition to the host of functions that we, our HR and our financial services teams accomplish on a daily basis, we've been busy automating a number of different kinds of services. These include recruitment processes, personnel action requests, leave slips, charitable activities reporting, and crime victim payment application and reimbursement processes, just to name a few. We've also outstationed two of our three HR analysts around the state in our geographically separated locations so that they could provide face-to-face and really be more accessible for our staff that are located in other locations in Salem. Our IS team is actually, they did the work, the automation that I talked about on the previous slide. We've also implemented voice over IP across the agency, getting rid of an old legacy phone system. Interestingly, this has allowed our help desk technicians to roam from division to division, from location to location, and provide services on site rather than them sitting all in a central location trying to take all the calls, do everything over the phone. So that's really added added value to our services in the field. We've also replaced our old video conferencing system, and that has allowed us to integrate with our VoIP system so they can talk to each other. Particularly, I'm proud of us scoring a favorable assessment by the Secretary of State just a few months back. And our POP 101, this is a re-baselining of RIS costs, and I'll talk a little bit more about the limitation in our phase two presentation. And our operations team has been working busily on consolidating locations, as you can see here. We've recently, during this biennium, relocated from four locations to two in Salem and Bend, and recently consolidated our crime victims section into the Justice Building. We've also been partnering with landlords to make better, more sustainable workspaces for our employees. Those are just a few examples of how we've done that, upgrading building lighting and creating sustainable and efficient workspaces. And then we've been working on some sustainable other options as well. We've also been returning a few cars back to DAS that were underutilized. So we have three primary budget drivers, and those are, for the most part, the program needs within our divisions. So the priorities of the clients of DOJ drive what our divisions do, and what our divisions need drives what we do. That's from our administration of grants to technology delivery. Also, the rapid rate of technology has, the change just really has been driving us. And the information security requirements have just constantly morphed. And finally, regulatory requirements. You can see just a few of the rules that really keep us on our toes.
Can you elaborate a little bit on some of the challenges with respect to HIPAA?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I don't have a lot of that information available. Specifically with HIPAA is that we don't, in the administrative services division, we don't handle a lot of HIPAA information. However, in our legal division, specifically in trial and appellate, when they're trying a case, when they're doing their work, they hold information from other agencies that may contain HIPAA or FTI or that kind of information. So what we do is we're responsible for the systems, providing them the support to keep that secure. So I can't address in depth the HIPAA other than our programs in DOJ use it.
I get it.
And we help them keep it. Okay, thank you.
I thought maybe that there was something coming out that's more onerous than what's already in place.
I hope not. Not aware of any. A few major changes that we've been experiencing. First of all, the increasing support requirements associated with the large child support program or project Origin, as Kate spoke about a little bit earlier. Also supporting an increasingly mobile DOJ workforce and the logistics and security that are associated with that. We've been upgrading the department's internet and intranet websites. And we're dealing with the increased complexity, as I just mentioned, and number of both cyber threats and regulatory issues that are associated with those. And finally, a large undertaking that we're just kicking through is the modernizing of our legal practice software. We have an older homegrown system, and we're in the process of implementing a COTS system that replaces our case management, document management, billing, and time capture software. So we'll have those in one place rather than in multiple systems. This is a list of our of just a few of our efficiencies. I had a long list, but although I was proud to talk about those, I didn't bring them all. The common thread here is that you'll see that we're looking under every stone and every process just to be as efficient as we possibly can and to help the programs that we support be as efficient as they can. Here is the short list of our policy packages that we'll talk about in phase two. Those are in the governor's budget. And my least favorite slide here is the list of our 15%, 5, 10, and 15% reductions. So that's all I have for today, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions you have. Thank you for your time.
Any questions? All right.
Thank you.
Anything else for the good of the order?
Thanks, Mark.
Well, then we will close our public hearing and adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Chart and